It is May the 31st, 2019, and this is episode 10 of the official podcast of the Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care. Coming up on this episode, we look at how to approach facial wounds. We discuss IV versus oral antibiotics for the treatment of cellulitis. We discuss what eardrops to use when the tympanic membrane is ruptured. We discuss using tramadol. And we look over some news items, including Bongella overdosing and an interesting case of chronic compartment syndrome. Okay, so welcome to episode 10 of the Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care's official podcast. My name is Guy Melrose and I'm your host. And I'm joined as ever by Dr. David Sorrell, our Director of Clinical Training. Welcome, Dave.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we'll jump straight in with a look back at some of our bites from this month. And if we start with the facial wound bite. Now, this was a story that Bruce Arrell mentioned when we talked to him a while back, and he'd just commented on a couple of outback situations in Canada, and I think Thames Hospital was the other one, where he'd seen somebody with a chainsaw through the face, and because of circumstance, he repaired them and was amazed at how well they had recovered. And so it made him think the face has a good blood supply and that they therefore will recover. But there's a bit of a minefield dealing with facial wounds, and there's a lot of things to step through. So I was interested in what people thought. Our director of professional development gave me some feedback before he disappeared to Las Vegas, and he commented on it depends on your local kind of population, and he works around people who for whom a scar is very undesirable, both in themselves or their children. And so he tends to refer a lot of facial wounds for a plastic surgical review. And I'm sure we'd get a different opinion from somebody who worked maybe in a rural setting with old farmers and old rugby players. So what are your thoughts, Dave, on facial wounds, and how do you personally approach them?
So the face has excellent blood supply, which means that you can repair even if there is a delayed presentation. As always, you have to examine very, very carefully to make sure that there's no skull fracture. Are the facial muscles partially divided? You've got to pay particular attention to the ear and making sure that the cartilage is opposed properly, the nose as well, which has got skin and cartilage, and around the eye. Those areas are particularly important. The vermilliform border of the lip must be immaculately repaired. So my perspective is this: the face has excellent blood supply, which means it needs the best repair possible immediately. Now, sometimes that may mean a referral to a service better able to manage that, such as plastics or pediatrics. Sometimes sedation may be required so that you can do this possibly. Experience in facial nerve blocks and having the right equipment is also very important. So my perspective is you must get the best repair immediately that you can. When there's tissue loss and damage, then often things can be repaired down the track at 3 months or 6 months. And so if it can be repaired immediately, repair it as well as you can immediately. And then I always follow up the significant facial wounds with plastics as well. And I consult early for those ones.
So you make a decision to refer early. Obviously, the primary repair is the one point at which you can refer, or you can refer later, because obviously ACC is part of the New Zealand system here that will at least enable access to a private plastic surgeon at a later date. We had an email from Richard Galea, who gave his opinions on this. He describes a case back that somebody else had sutured that he followed up, of a young woman who was very worried about the cosmetic result because there was a 4 to 5 millimeter kind of step in the wound following suturing. And she wasn't very happy with that initially, but they observed this for a little bit longer and allowed time to play out a bit more. And then it eventually ended up with a reasonable cosmetic repair at the end of the story. So he said it's for him, that was another good example of how forgiving the face can be. I think it's a good example of keeping an eye on these wounds. Certainly, it's good to review them. But once you've made the decision to repair, you think it's vital to make as good as perfect a job as possible on day one. And if you can't do that, refer.
Yes. And you know, it does depend where you work and what you've got availability and what equipment you have and how skilled you are at facial nerve blocks, like infraorbital nerve blocks and mental nerve blocks for the lip and things. So sometimes you just don't have the time, you know, to repair an ear with cartilage damage fully. You know, often takes up to an hour. And so sometimes that should be done somewhere else.
Yeah, that's a good point. Time is always a challenge if you've got a busy waiting room. And Richard also mentioned with regards to children, he probably uses glue and Steri-Strips a little bit more. And that's obviously a quicker or potentially a quicker a job. But
And when you're using glue, you've got to be very careful around the eye because you don't want to glue the eye shut. When you're using glue, you must have the edges immaculate when you apply the glue. You can't just put the glue into the hole. Steri-Strips, quite challenging on some areas of the face, and it's quite good to use thin Steri-Strips with glue together. So the strip holds it together, and then the glue holds it more permanently. And the glue is really good. And obviously on the scalp, you can use the hair apposition technique where you twist strands of hair and apply glue to that so that you don't get the glue stuck around the wound and it will just come off in 10 days.
And it's important if the wound is deeper, if you're just closing the skin with Steri-Strips, you might be forming a space deeper down that's going to fill with blood and not heal. So the temptation with a kid to put Steri-Strips on is probably there, but I often do refer kids because they won't sit still, and if they don't sit still, we can't get an adequate result. And obviously, there's more of a concern about cosmetics in kids. So it's certainly a tricky one. But your feeling is, if you can't get it right, refer. And obviously, if you've done plastics for 15 years before you've done urgent care, your skill set is going to be greater than others. Moving on to the next topic was a chat we had with Justin Morganston. There was two we're going to discuss today. The first one we'll talk about is the tramadol opinion. Now, Justin's blog is very interesting to read. He does a lot of evidence-based reviews of things relevant to emergency medicine, and a lot of them are also relevant to us in urgent care. And the tramadol use one is one of his latest posts, and his feeling is that tramadol is, because there's that step, that metabolizing step from getting from tramadol to the opioid, it makes for a very random dosing because you don't know what kind of a metabolizer that person is, and there's the SNRI effects that can come alongside it. So he's more comfortable just with pure morphine. And it certainly makes sense listening to his arguments, and there's been a lot of debate on the comments on his Facebook and his blog site. What are your thoughts on tramadol?
So I would like everyone to refer back to the podcast by Linda Bryant in December 2017 that's available on the Goodfellow webinar. And she refers to the pharmacological management of acute pain. So I think that the points that Justin raises are extremely valid, but you need to consider the patient and pain relief as a whole. And I have a little bit of concern about the statement, just use morphine. In the US, the opioid epidemic killed 64,000 people last year, and we must be mindful of preventing opioid use disorder. So yes, you should be very, very careful when you do use tramadol, but you should also be very careful when you use morphine. And Linda Bryant talks about the use of morphine or oxycodone and its lack of effectiveness, especially in any persistent pain. So I think that the points raised about the SNRI effect of tramadol and the dosing and addiction are very valid, but I'm not sure that we should be using more morphine. That's probably all I have to say about that.
There was a comment on our Facebook page that I think is interesting because it does ask the question, well, if we can't use, say, in an elderly person, an anti-inflammatory, and if tramadol, codeine, and opiates have the problems that you've just mentioned, what can we use for pain relief? And it seems that there's an awful lot of reasons not to use a lot of pain medications, but we do need to use them because we see people in pain and people who are injured a lot. So it is a tricky one, isn't it?
It's the classical catch 22.
And I think certainly my take from Justin's talk was the pharmacology was interesting, being aware of that metabolizing step and the complications that can have. The problem with, again, just using morphine is that it requires getting the controlled drug script out and all the duplicate paperwork, which adds to the time also. But it also then sets a precedent for expectations from patients, which is tricky to use. So I think it's an interesting talk to listen to, and it's an interesting blog to read, but ultimately I'm not sure, as you say, whether just using morphine is the option from our point of view.
And when morphine is used, then it should be very well managed by the patient's own doctor. So morphine should always be used with extreme caution in intermittent care, such as emergency medicine and urgent care, and that it's perfectly okay for a GP who is seeing the patient regularly and managing their pain relief needs to be doing that. We just have to be very careful how much we use it in the community.
Yeah, it's almost a trigger for referral if somebody's come in so much pain that you're considering going up to morphine, then that usually requires them to be seeing a surgeon or having some further investigation at the hospital. So discharging somebody from an urgent care clinic on morphine, I think is very rare that I've done that. In fact, I can not really think of any cases recently. So, yeah, you've got to be mindful of that.
Yes.
The next topic was the most recent bite, and I'm in the process of trying to get an ENT specialist to talk on this because it's something that troubles me. If you know someone has a tympanostomy tube, and if you know that somebody has a perforation that you can see, and they've got otitis externa or they've got an otorrhea, then the treatment recommendation is an eardrop, but the eardrops that are recommended are ototoxic, with the exception of the ciprofloxacin eye drop, and that's only subsidized if you endorse it as a second-line treatment for chronic suppurative otitis media, which kind of means you're then having to treat first-line with something that's potentially ototoxic, or goes against best practice and uses an oral antibiotic for what should be a topical treatment. And yet, when you look in all the New Zealand formularies and when you look at the MedSafe data sheets, etc., they all say the words contraindicated, and that always sits badly with me. And yet, you talk to an ENT surgeon and they're quite, no, it's fine, just use them for a few days until the infection clears and it should be fine. So...
Yeah, so I mean... When you read the descriptions and you line up all the eardrops and they have a column and description, use if tympanic membrane perforated. And the answer is no from a pharmacological point of view. And that is extremely challenging. And so we have a catch 22, and we know that the surgeons tend to use ciprofloxacin HC because they're allowed to authorize that and we're not allowed to. So ciprofloxacin eye drops in the ear is my preferred drop when I'm concerned about ototoxicity or unsure. And I think that with the discharging ear, that's what I tend to go through first. It's just a shame that we can't get this over the line with pharmac and funding.
And then, particularly with otitis externa, one of the recommendations is ear suctioning is preferable, and certainly that enables you to then confirm an intact tympanic membrane if there's too much debris to confirm it yourself, or and if there's not a history that they've had recent grommet insertion. But there's a cost for that as well, so this can end up being quite a costly endeavour for patients and families, either paying for drops
It's really an access problem there, that with children in Auckland, it's relatively good because you have the nurse practitioner run ear clinic and the mobile ear clinic, and you can send in a referral and they'll usually see them the next day or so. Where in adults, you have to send them to a private ear nurse specialist unless it's extremely bad, like necrotizing otitis externa, where you can send it in acutely. And so I did have a patient recently who was seen by an ear nurse specialist, who then referred him on to the hospital, where the ENT person put in a anti-mycotic preparation into the ear canal to kill what was actually a fungal ear infection, because under microscope they could see the hypha consistent with a chronic fungal infection. And that's certainly not something I have access to, these drug-eluting gels that they put inside the ear.
So, yeah, just as we've been speaking, hot off the press, I've had an email from a reply from one of the ENT surgeons I contacted. So they're happy to talk on this topic on the podcast. So we'll come back to this one at a later date, maybe once we've spoken to them about this topic, because if it wasn't for the contraindicated, if it said use with caution, then you feel a little bit better. We use a lot of drugs, maybe slightly off license, or you know, we've got to balance these things up. But it's the fact that they come down on that contraindicated side of the equation bothers me. But that said, as I say, we will come back to this one in the future. The final thing to discuss is the thing that went up today, the interview today, and that was again with Justin Morganston. This was a longer interview talking about his readings around IV versus oral antibiotics for cellulitis. And unlike the tramadol one, you don't find this one quite as challenging. You agree that orals are the preferred way. Is that right, Dave?
Absolutely. So there's been a lot of discussion around adequate oral antibiotics, and I've been talking to the POAC people about enhancing the protocols. One of the issues we face is that it can be cheaper for the patient if they're treated with IV antibiotics because of the subsidized IV antibiotic protocols. And ideally, you'd want to be able to get funded reviews, so to avoid IV antibiotics. And that's something that I've been trying to discuss, but not quite getting any leeway at the moment. And I think most of the time you should start with oral antibiotics. The study from Otago that showed using flucloxacillin 1 gram TDS with food as being equally efficacious as the 500 milligrams QID on an empty stomach is really good, and that's the protocol I currently use for most simple cellulitis. I think that obviously I'm more cautious about, you know, how unwell is the patient, and if the patient is really unwell, they should be in hospital with IV antibiotics. I think that the big thing is to choose your location carefully as well, and if you've got significant facial cellulitis, that should be reviewed in hospital for advanced imaging sometimes. That hand infections require really close monitoring. That animal bites require close monitoring and sometimes operations. And of course, that abscesses shouldn't be managed with IV antibiotics. They should be managed with adequate drainage, and that sometimes requires hospital. I think everyone should have a trial of oral antibiotics for at least 24 to 48 hours. And that it is very challenging, but oral should be the way to go in most circumstances.
I think one interesting thing I was made aware of was the toxin release as an improving cellulitis occurs can make the erythema spread further beyond the demarcated line that you might have drawn the day you started the antibiotics, and that can happen up to 48 hours into treatment. So we may be seeing somebody the next day and thinking, oh, that's worsening, let's go to IVs, but actually it's part of an improving process. So I thought that was an interesting thing to maybe we need to be observing these people, and if they're well, clinically well, then observe them longer before going to the IVs. And the logical way I like the way that Justin looked at this was the way in which the antibiotic gets into the bloodstream. The bacteria doesn't know how it got into there. If you can get the levels to the required levels to treat that bacteria, it doesn't matter whether it came in through the mouth, through the stomach, or through an IV line. And the cases he listed for when you use an IV is when people can't swallow or have a gut absorption problem or are significantly septic, that their gut perfusion is going to reduce the absorption. But the bioavailability of most of the drugs that we use is very high, and if we get the dosing right, then the bugs should get they should get the same level as whether we gave it through IV.
A really good example of that is for instance, in the truly penicillin allergic patient, clindamycin has extremely good bioavailability. And so, you know, you're using clindamycin orally rather than IV anyway. It's just the problem is that you can't just prescribe it. Usually you have to discuss it with infectious diseases to check that it's the right thing to do. So, I don't think bacteria care where the antibiotic comes. It's the bioavailability, like you say.
And the other thing was there are some conditions which mimic cellulitis that we might be treating. He mentioned things like the lipodermatosclerosis. And in a future podcast, we're having a chat with a dermatologist about some of these conditions and identifying them and treating those. But as a good rule of thumb, he said that cellulitis shouldn't be bilateral and it shouldn't be itchy. And he lists some of the other considerations. So I guess if something is failing to respond to appropriate antibiotic, you've got to think of, is the diagnosis sound? Is it correct? And a point that I raised with him was the whitetail spider bites. And there's been studies out of Australia that showed that confirmed whitetail spider bites didn't have any higher incidence of infection. And maybe we're a little bit overly cautious about these. Do you have a thought about whitetail bites?
I have a very strong opinion on whitetail spider bites, and I've been following this for well over a decade. The whitetail spider is not an evil Jedi, and there's no association between whitetail spider bites and the condition of necrotizing arachnidactism. So that is the ulcerating, disastrous flesh-eating infections. Now, that is associated with the brown recluse spider, but there are no brown recluse spiders in New Zealand. No one has ever identified a definite association between the whitetail spider and serious infections. You're much more likely to get a serious skin infection from a mosquito bite than you are from a whitetail.
We might come back to that topic if that's something you've followed along for a long time. We might get you to talk in more depth because we're up against the clock a little bit today. If we jump to the news now. Some New Zealand news. We talked on the very first podcast about the generic EpiPen that was potentially going to come out or get FDA approval in America. But there was an article in Stuff this month saying EpiPen's unlikely to be funded by Pharmac, which again is just a bit of a sigh, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's terrible. I mean, we know that in Australia it's funded, the EpiPen, and in New Zealand it's not. And it's an extremely expensive product, you know, as it says in that article, between $120 and $180, and they expire. So, you know, I'm extremely pro-funding of the EpiPens, and I think we don't hand them out willy-nilly. We only give them to people who it can save their life with. I can't understand that personally. Yes, it's expensive, but it's a lot less expensive than intensive care admissions and things like that.
Yeah. Yep. So we'll keep an eye on that one. Hopefully one day opinions will change in Pharmac. The other interesting case was a kiddie ended up in hospital following an appropriate use of Bongella, but had an overdose of it. And I was interested in, first of all, your thoughts on Bongella as a treatment for ulcers, and if there were any other ways of managing mucosal ulceration in kiddies.
Very challenging. So in teething, in stomatitis, you have a sore mouth. It's not like an adult where you can get them to gargle. It's very difficult to apply pastes to the mouth. And this was a great, another timely reminder about the toxicity of medicines. There is a bit of debate about using viscous lignocaine in young children, and I've looked into this a little bit, and there are conflicting arguments about outcome-wise, there's probably no difference between using viscous lignocaine and the risk of toxicity of that as well versus not. And so also, the funding is rather complicated. It's not really complicated. There is the lignocaine gel. So I tend to say to not use anything really other than maybe a little bit of Bongella very carefully. And I think it's a big challenge, and you just watch for dehydration.
Yeah, I think ice blocks are very good I find they chill and they hydrate and kind of chill and numb the mouth. From this Bongella case, this wasn't an they'd used it as prescribed, hadn't they? So it wasn't a misuse of the medication.
They're saying is it's confusing as to how much you're supposed to use. So that's probably the problem.
But this is something you can buy over the counter, isn't it? It doesn't require a doctor's prescription. So in some ways, I don't think I've ever prescribed it. It's something people can pick up, but I would usually direct people to the pharmacist if they ask about using Bongella. I'd ask them to, when they're taking their Pamol script to the pharmacy, ask them to speak to the pharmacist about it, because I've not got a great sort of personal opinion on it. I don't think I've used it myself, and it didn't seem to work that well. I find that the Orabase with Kenalog or Adcortil, it's sometimes called, works really well for adult ulceration. That's my favourite. But for kiddies, it tends to be ice blocks and Pamol for me. But yeah, it's certainly important to be aware of asking parents with sick children, particularly drowsy kids, you know, what have you been using? Because this salicylate poisoning could have presented through an urgent care as the kid was getting worse. And we sometimes forget to maybe consider over-the-counter preparations as medications. And I always remember, I think I've told the story once before, that this kid had swallowed a load of, or potentially swallowed a load of Vicks vapor rub. And actually, when you speak to poisons, the camphor oil is very, very toxic and can cause seizures and all sorts of horrible things. And yet you imagine, well, it's available in pharmacies and supermarkets, so what harm is it? So one thing I would take from this case is always making sure over-the-counter preparations are also included in any history, because they can cause some nasty effects.
Well, yes, it's very important to find out what OTC medicines people have had, because of course the cough and cold medicines often have paracetamol, and if they take Panadol with the cold Rex with Panadol, then there's a risk of overdose. So, and obviously with the Vicks, you've got the Vicks baby balm, and then you've got the normal Vicks. And there are risks of toxicity in both of those if they are ingested. So I kind of give a written advice sheet about how they use that and when they use it.
And then just quickly, Dave, because I know you've got to get away, I put on the bottom of our list there this compartment syndrome story from America, which I thought was an interesting one just to make people think. We're all aware of compartment syndrome secondary to a hefty blow or an injury of some kind. When this chap developed severe arm pain, but was a gym goer and an active sports person, and it progressed over a period of time, and he had tests for rhabdo as well as various other visits to the doctor, and then he was eventually diagnosed as having chronic compartment syndrome. Just cutting in with a little correction. Since recording the podcast, I've reread the news article, and this was actually a case of acute compartment syndrome, albeit one that appeared to have come on relatively slow and with fairly minimal trauma. There was, in fact, an underlying strep infection that contributed to this, and that is what makes this a very rare presentation. I apologise for getting the story a bit mixed up when we recorded. We were rushing against time at the end. Now back to your regularly scheduled podcast. Which, I don't know if you've come across a chronic compartment syndrome versus an acute compartment syndrome, but a lot of people nowadays are gym junkies and doing CrossFit and all these kind of triathlons and other things. So I wonder if we're going to see more as the population strives to be healthier.
Well, it's very interesting because I have seen acute exertional rhabdomyolysis in gym junkies, specifically in those starting doing CrossFit. So I saw a young woman who had forearm rhabdo with CKs in the 30,000 mark after and extremely painful arms. And to be honest, I didn't think of compartment syndrome at that time. And perhaps that she didn't have compartment syndrome, but she did have rhabdomyolysis, and it was very, very painful. And it was is quite challenging. So this case is extremely interesting. I've never seen chronic compartment syndrome. I've seen exertional compartment syndrome, and particularly in the calf muscle of athletes. So I had a friend of my son's who had exertional compartment syndrome and had to have operations to relieve that, because otherwise, basically, he'd start playing football and running, and 30 minutes in, his legs cramped up severely. And so it should be considered as a cause of recurrent cramp in athletes. But, you know, usually we think of compartment syndrome as there's been a crush and there's extreme pain and paresthesia, et cetera. And that's usually reasonably easy to spot. This sounds like a very challenging case and something to bear in mind, I guess.
Yeah, and the degree of severity of his pain, we'd be referring likely with that kind of differential of, is this rhabdo? And then it'll be somebody else who'll end up going down the differential list. But as you say, that exertional compartment syndrome that kind of settles when they're not exerting themselves is one that might come through the doors because... You know, if they're not
and challenging to say, you know, is that ACC in New Zealand? That's very hard. The rhabdomyolysis, acute exertional or exercise-induced rhabdomyolysis, that resulted in a six-week struggle with ACC, eventually talking to the medical advisor and saying, look, this is a one-off. That person did this exercise routine, came in the day after, had lots of pain, raise CK suggesting an injury, how can I avoid this in the future? And in actual fact, it's not very well understood. So I guess it's to write extra information on the ACC form saying this is definitely an injury caused by an action. So whereas exertional compartment syndrome is probably not going to be covered by ACC, unfortunately.
So, yeah, that was just an interesting one. There's been other cases in the news that we could talk about. Obviously, measles is still around and the like, but I think that's enough for this week, Dave. So thanks again for joining us. I will put links to both Justin's discussions on tramadol and cellulitis for people who haven't heard those yet to have a read. And I'll also link to that podcast from the Goodfellow that you mentioned, because I think that's probably from our discussions today, that's an important one for people to maybe follow from here, is that we're not really giving an answer on the tramadol. I think that's a discussional debate that but people should be very mindful of how they use opioids in general. So we'll link to that. And as I say, hopefully soon we'll have a discussion on with an ENT surgeon and get some good debate around those eardrops. And coming up in the next week or so, I've recorded something live from Kathmandu, and that's not the clothing shop, that's the country. Dinesh Dionarain is on his way home from a stint on Everest Base Camp working as a doctor there. So we've had a chat with him. So that'll be coming up, but we'll see you again in a month, Dave. Thanks for joining us.
Great. See you next time.
Cool. Thanks for listening. The information discussed in this podcast was intended for the ongoing professional development of qualified health professionals and should not be used for self-diagnosis. For any personal medical concerns, please consult your usual doctor.